Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. For the past 3 months, thousands of people across the country have been raising their voices against the rising inequality and the financial crisis, which has left millions of Americans unemployed, dealing with foreclosures, and struggling to make ends meet. Journalist Naomi Prinz's new historical novel takes us back to another similar era when, on October 24th, 1929, stock prices plummeted and people watched their money evaporate. The novel Black Tuesday is a historical look set in New York City on the eve of the great stock market crash of 1929, and it traces the story of Leila Khan, an Eastern European immigrant who lives on the Lower East Side of Manhattan in a fifth-floor walk-up. Against her better judgment, Leila falls for banker Roderick Morgan, who is involved in a fraudulent financial deal with his uncle Jack Morgan. The Black Tuesday story mirrors what millions of Americans have experienced as the result of the most recent financial crisis. Naomi Prinz has worked for Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, and Bear Stearns, so she knows what goes on behind the scenes on Wall Street. She is now a journalist and author of her first novel, Black Tuesday. Hi, Naomi. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, hi. Thank you so much for having me back on.
It's great to have you. Now, before we dive in and talk about your book and why you decided to write a historical novel, I want to ask you about something you've said in a couple of recent interviews, and I'd like you to elaborate on this. You say that the worst part of this economic crisis is still unfolding into a greater depression, and this is not being talked about in Washington. Can you talk about that?
The issue is that as we saw the subprime component of what I think is this ongoing financial crisis unfold in the fall of 2008, Washington, the regulators, did very little, basically did nothing to thwart the continuation of that component of the crisis and the possibility of it getting worse and being prolonged in the future years. And we've seen that. They have the opportunity in 2008, for example, to break up the banks, to reinvoke Glass-Steagall, which would do that, to reduce significantly the risk and the derivatives exposure and all the funky securities that these banks create. They did none of those things. So now we're 3 years further on. We have the European component of this crisis unfolding. We have banks bigger than they were. We have banks riskier than they were. We have derivatives positions 30% higher than they were 3 years ago. And we have regulators who most recently in the MF Global collapse have completely abdicated responsibility, accountability, and competence. So this is what we're dealing with. So when you're starting from that situation, things can't unfortunately get better without becoming far worse first.
And what does that mean exactly? Where do you think this is going?
Well, all of the risk in the system, and we can see this unfolding in Europe. The main media's stories about what's going on in Europe and how they impact the United States is because certain countries are shown to be weakening, Italy and Spain and Portugal and Ireland and Greece. It's going to have an impact on, say, keeping the United States in a second dip or double dip recession. Now, I do not believe that we've ever been out of a recession, and I believe that there are certain definitions by which this recession really is a depression. If you look at the real unemployment and underemployment levels, if you look at the real foreclosure figures, if you look at the real insolvency of the financial system that is simply being bolstered by the federal government and cheap money and various subsidies, that we have a very shaky foundation. Now, we look at Europe having a shaky foundation. We've caused a lot of that, i.e. our policies and our banking system, because we're in a very global financial network. And from Europe, that follows into China and India and so forth, and it goes towards Latin America. We have this circular financial system risk-producing set of institutions that have no opposition from regulators or central banks or government leaders. And so that's why we're still in this downward spiral. Risk hasn't been reduced. These practices haven't been curtailed. And the influence and power of the financial system hasn't been cut back.
And you write in your book that while it took a while from the crash of 1929 to examine what the banks were doing, there was action. And you're talking about a Republican Treasury Secretary under a Democratic president who said, we have to make sure this doesn't happen again. Right.
Well, exactly. And the fact that it was a joint combination of FDR, who was a Democrat, and Wooden, who was a Treasury Secretary initially, who was a Republican. And this is a guy who wasn't just a Republican. He was on the preferred stock list of the Morgan Bank. I mean, this was a person very connected to Wall Street. And certainly what happened several years later with the PCORA Commission, which investigated what Wall Street had done and their role in the 1929 crash and inflating stocks and creating fraud and decimating the general economy, was examined. And from that, the Glass-Steagall Act was passed, which separated banks into components where the commercial side dealt with customer deposits and loans, and the FDIC was created to back those deposits so there wouldn't be a situation where people's money was at risk just because on the other side of a bank there was a lot of speculation and fraud and all kinds of shenanigan activity going on. Those things were separated. This time around, not only have they not been separated, they have been grown. The speculative activities, the derivatives, the risks that these banks take are higher than it was going into the subprime crisis in 2008. And these institutions are in control of more assets of the American public, whether they be in deposits or in home mortgages or student loans, auto loans, and so forth.
So let's talk about your novel and why you decided to take a look at what's going on, what happened during the crash of 1929. And you say there are so many similarities between what happened then and what's happening right now. First off, you've written a few nonfiction books, and you were on our show maybe it was last year, talking about pillage. Why did you decide to write a historical novel about the stock market crash?
A couple of different reasons. One is I honestly got sick and tired of talking about the same things in terms of statistics and information from SEC documents and Federal Reserve reports and everything else. And I wanted to look back at the human element of a time gone by where we had very similar occurrences between what the financial system did to the country in terms of destroying the economic infrastructure of the country, how that was paralleled today, but through the eyes of real people rather than just talking about it in sort of historical anecdotes, looking at how that line between someone, you know, Lila Khan, who is an immigrant who comes here from across the ocean to find that American dream that's being promised, that's being discussed, that is a hope, and seeing that as much as you can struggle and work and so forth, there are these forces beyond your control, and in the case of the 20s and now the banking system community, who can basically take everything from your family, from, in her case, her heart, and really turn it upside down. And what happens when someone who doesn't start out to be a heroine or an activist or a protester or anything, or just wants to, you know, have a normal life and just attain some sort of normal stability, gets caught up in very dark and shady activities, and what she does with that. And she has a lot of struggle in the book. She's back and forth. There are times where I just want to smack her for saying, you know, dumb things and sort of even supporting what the bankers are doing and using the lines that we actually hear now today about how, well, they're just creating jobs, they're just helping, they're just caught up in this down spiral as well, as opposed to having caused it. But also dealing with her family life, her sick aunt, her cousins who are workers at the fishing docks in New York City, the Fulton Fish Market area, and just really looking at how a human family is impacted by things beyond their control and beyond their knowledge.
And she also sees so much poverty in her world and on the streets, and compares that to what she sees on Wall Street and the world that she's entering.
Right, exactly. She's coming in this. I did a lot of historical research on this. This was a time in the late 20s, right before the crash itself, at the end of 1929, where newspapers were talking about the boom, where the Ladies' Home Journal was trying to get women to buy stocks, where all of this, you know, euphoria, astrologists were talking about the market going on forever, was present. And at the same time, as she goes home, everybody is struggling. The rents are difficult to come by. There are these pushcart peddlers who sell their wares in the street, who are being pushed out by the store owners, who are being funded by outsiders from the neighborhood, and that's hurting, you know, all the local economy there and the local just life. And she goes every day to work to Wall Street area, where she's a manager of a diner, and where she sees these bankers just talking about their money and their stocks and their bets and their investments as if none of this is happening, which is no different from what is occurring now. It was perhaps simpler to focus on an element of the past in a specific location than I did, but it's really what we see today as well throughout the country.
And, you know, in reading this, because at first when we got the book, we thought Nomi Prinz wrote a historical novel, because your nonfiction books have been so good. But the more we read the book, we sort of were thinking, well, maybe this is easier to digest, because whenever we have on journalists who focus on the economy, they often tell us, well, we're not really hearing about this issue or that issue because it's so complicated, right? It's very hard for people to understand what's going on. Or, you know, why isn't that question, why haven't more people been prosecuted despite evidence of mounting fraud? Well, you know, it's already been done. How do you revisit it and revisit it? So do you feel like you might be able to reach more people in this manner because it's told more from sort of the human perspective and it has more heart involved?
Well, that's actually a really great question, because that was a lot of my intent, to not just teach a reader about the crash in 1929 and what happened, and there is certainly historical fact throughout the book, but to show the heart, the aspect of humanity that can be destroyed, again, by forces outside of your own control. And when you're only trying to live your own life, and you've got issues with men, and you've got issues with your family, and you've got this balance between tradition and where the world is going so quickly. At the time, radio was developed, and that was this crazy new technology, and there was like only one family on the street that might have one in their house, and they would like leave their windows open so that the music could play everywhere. There was this time of change, and at the same time, there was this lot of dark forces, but there was a lot of heart. And looking back, it was, to me, simpler to look at a very parallel aspect of history and show that human component and through these characters and look at how it's as a journalist, you're really talking about a lot of black and white and facts, and as a human, you have to really process it through your heart and through your mind, and that's what Lila does in the book. Even the banker characters, you know, some of them are more villainous than others. Everybody has complexities in their own person, and it's my hope that people can relate to that, and maybe it is a way to more easily digest a book than sitting down and reading about history and crunching through facts and newspaper clippings or whatever it might be summarized, and just, you know, take the story for what it is. It's a story of someone going through that time, but it also does have elements of fact that you can process as you want, or just enjoy it, you know, for the story itself.
And you did a lot of research for this novel. What struck you about what really happened in 1929?
Well, there was a woman I actually met in Los Angeles who was a child during that time, and she was telling her story, and one of the things that really struck me was that her father was a very prudent man. He had a contracting office on the Lower East Side, which one of the characters here is based on, and he was very careful. He didn't buy anything on credit. He didn't invest in the market. He didn't do any of those things. He was very opposed to betting, and his partner basically ruined him in the stock market, and so there's that dichotomy that really wasn't brought up as much at the time in the papers. Looking back, we can sort of see what must have happened, but listening to people's stories, there was a lot of different interpretations of what was going on, you know, whether you get involved in the market, whether you don't, how even if you don't, you're impacted, and I thought that was really interesting. And also looking at some of the newspaper clippings in terms of the activists and the workers and the labor side of what was going on back then, you had a lot of, in this boom, supposedly roaring 20s, a lot of unrest you had in certain places in the south of the country where workers were protesting in textile factories and so forth. There were local policemen beating them up and throwing them in jail. There were mayors who were turning against them. And now, and the book came out right before all the Occupy movements grew, but I saw how this stuff was going on, and it was relegated to, you know, page 27, 39, 48 in newspapers, where the front pages were all about the market and the bankers and the economy. And so even back then, there was this real pushing towards the end of the news what was happening in the worker and labor community. And there's a character in the book who is very much an activist, who's Lila's current boyfriend, who's not a banker, who's involved in all of that. So it's very interesting to look at how that unfolded at the time when our knowledge of history is about the boom. But really, if you peel it back, that's not what's going on for a lot of the country.
What did the media coverage look like back then? You have a passage in your book where the paper boy was yelling, "Banks run out of dough, get your paper."
Right. There was much more, you know, people didn't go online. You know, people were buying papers that were their information source, and radio, again, was just starting, so that became the information source. And before that, it had been clips that were shown in movie theaters and such that were very much stylized news and stylized for the time. And so there was much more discussion of news in the streets. You know, you'd get the newspaper from the paper boy. You'd want to know what was going on, even though you're experiencing it. That paper boy's talking as he's on Wall Street, as everything is falling apart and crashing. And still there's this need to know, and then there's much more discussion in the streets because you're holding the paper, you're talking to the guy next to you. There's a lot more interaction, I think, on that level than now we have it online, and it's sort of in comments and in chat rooms and so forth, and we have 24/7 news. So back then it was much more visceral and immediate from the standpoint of people connecting, and it was, news was social.
We're speaking,
social media makes it social.
We're speaking with Nomi Prinz, who has worked for Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, and Bear Stearns, and she's now a journalist and author of her first novel, Black Tuesday, which takes us back to the Great Depression. And she wrote this because she really wants us to look at the parallels between what happened back then and today. And she says she decided to write a novel to just make the financial crisis more human. And if you'd have any questions for Nomi about her own experience, we'll talk with her later in the show about what happened on Wall Street when she was an analyst at these firms. And what are your thoughts about where we are right now? What do you make of what happened this year? And where do you think we're going with the economy? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org, or you can leave a comment on our new website, yourcallradio.org. So why don't we talk a little bit more about the reaction to the crash of 1929? Who decided to take real action? I mean, how much influence did... Okay, so when you look at parallels, how much influence did the banks have on politicians back then compared to the influence they have today?
They had tremendous influence back then as well as today. The very slight difference was the lobbying mechanism and the sort of bulking together campaign contributions mechanism was a little less sophisticated. It happened. It just wasn't officially happening. The Treasury Secretary, Andrew Mellon, who was the Treasury Secretary under three presidents in the 20s when there was this boom, supposedly the Roaring 20s were happening economically, was a banker, and his friends were bankers, and he thought like a banker, and he ultimately got kicked out of his position as Treasury Secretary under President Herbert Hoover as the Great Depression was really rolling out, because, among other things, he was it was suggested that there was some tax evasion that was going on with respect to his banks and moving money around for his relatives and sort of hiding it here and there. And there was some investigation going on then, and he sort of like quit and started focusing on being kind of an ambassador to Europe and things like that. So there was a lot of that kind of connection between the banking community and what a banker could do as a Treasury Secretary and so forth. And of course, I've seen that now with former Goldman co-CEO Robert Rubin being the Treasury Secretary under President Clinton, and then Henry Paulson, another former CEO of Goldman Sachs, being the Treasury Secretary under Bush. So that stuff is very, very similar. The notion that when the crash happened, President Hoover said that things were back to normal almost immediately afterwards, and there were a lot of phone calls that were, at the time, you know, simpler, or telegraphs and letters and so forth back and forth between Wall Street and Washington, where the bankers at the time, Jack Morgan, who was one of the most powerful bankers, was conversing with Hoover, just like happens now, and telling him that things were fine, even though they were not fine. These banks were losing their solvency back then, just as they are now. The difference was now the government bailed them out, and then they kind of tried to bail themselves out. Small banks were crushed then, small banks were crushed now. So a lot of the power plays were in place. They've just become more magnified now because markets are faster. There's more money in politics than there was before. Everything's magnified, but a lot of the mechanisms are the same.
What about the revolving door back then?
Well, as well, again, Wooden was the Treasury Secretary who was a major investor in Wall Street, and he became a Treasury Secretary, and Andrew Mellon had his own bank, major bank, and he became Treasury Secretary, and a lot of the senators were back and forth as well. So there was a revolving door back then. There was a little bit more of a notion of public service than we have now. I don't know actually what the data is. It'd be interesting. We know now that over half of Congress are millionaires, if not more. I'm not sure what the number was and the comparable was back then. It was probably a lot of wealthy people were also in Congress, but I think the numbers of overall might have been less as a total percentage of Congress. But the power was still the same. The connection between Washington and Wall Street was still very, very strong. And the reason that FDR could come in and really beat the banks down and declare a bank holiday and ultimately pass the Glass-Steagall Act was because the country was so depressed that these bankers for a minute were weakened as well, and there was much more voter anger and population visceral reaction to it, and that was why FDR got elected. And unlike President Obama, he made good on some of the promises to right the wrongs that the bankers had done.
We're speaking with Nomi Prinz about her historical novel, Black Tuesday. And let's take a call before we go to break. Let's hear from William in Belvedere. Hi, William. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you very much. I'd appreciate the guest perspective on this. Although it is said that we are living above our means, we have been, and that's what's caused the problem, when someone looked around during the Depression, or looked around now as our recession deepens, they see that, despite the fact that we're told we're living above our means, if you look, there are plenty of factories, there are plenty of mines, there are plenty of resources, etc. And I think that that can lead people to say, you know, we just need somebody to take charge and get things straightened out. That equals authoritarianism, or an appeal of authoritarianism. And I wondered what the guest perspective was on whether, if the situation does not improve, there may be a move towards authoritarianism because of the obvious fact that there are plenty of resources, plenty of factories, etc., that things just aren't running right, would be the view that people would have.
Well, that's a good question. I think we have a form of political financial authoritarianism in that the financial community has enjoyed a lot of support, not just financially, not just in terms of cheap money and federal support, but also verbal in terms of philosophy that if the banks are running, the country is running. I mean, this is something that Tim Geithner, the current Treasury Secretary, has said. Obama has basically said in different ways as well. And it folds into some of the factories, the production, and everything else, because everything is all of these.
And Nomi, hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. Thanks for the call, William. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call here on Local Public Radio, KALW. Every week or two, we send out our email newsletter that keeps folks up on what's going on at Local Public Radio and where you can connect with us at events around the Bay Area. It's free. Just click on the Sign Up for E-News link at KALW.org. That's KALW.org. Sign up for the E-News link, and then you'll receive the email newsletter as soon as it comes out. Back to Rose Aguilar on Your Call. It's 10:30.
Thank you.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there, sign up for our newsletter, and you can now leave comments on our new website at yourcallradio.org. Tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about books. What were your favorite books this year? We'd love to hear your recommendations tomorrow. Thursday, we'll take a look back at the Arab Spring and the movement for democracy across the Middle East and North Africa. Today, we are talking about the current state of the economy. We're talking about the crash of 1929 and where we're going from here. We're joined by Nomi Prinz, who has worked for Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, and Bear Stearns. She's now a journalist, and she's out with her first historical novel, Black Tuesday. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions for Nomi about why she left Wall Street, for example, we'll talk about that later in the show. Or if you'd like to talk about what we're currently facing, how are you making sense of what we're facing? What do you think about what we dealt with this year? And where do you think we're heading in 2012? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. And Nomi, sorry to cut you off there. Why don't you finish your thought to William's call?
Right. We were talking about whether we're going to have a more authoritarian type of government. And I was saying that effectively we have this authoritarian collaboration between the financial system and the government to begin with. And that is what is the seed or what feeds into factories and other types of production firms and so forth. Because if there's money coming through the banking system and it's going to the bigger companies, those are the ones that effectively get the benefit, and the smaller ones don't and can't get loans and everything else. So that's just by default. We get a system where the centralized money has more power and dictates how the economy is going or not going, and the smaller and middle-sized companies and individuals have less of that. So I think I see that continuing, only because, again, there's no opposition to, for example, getting banks to lend more, to restructure mortgages more, and all the things we've been talking about for years hasn't really changed. It's really just gotten worse. There was a report just recently where small businesses are at their lowest in terms of getting loans from banks in over a decade, and that number is really startling. So I don't think we're looking as people for this change to come from the upper echelons of Washington. It would be nice if it did, but I think it's going to be on a more local level that things are really going to move.
So can you elaborate on that? Because sometimes we feel like we're hitting our head against the wall and saying the same thing over and over again. I mean, on this show, every Tuesday, we talk about the economy. We've talked about Glass-Steagall. We've asked why hasn't one Wall Street executive been prosecuted despite mounting fraud. Just on 60 Minutes recently, they interviewed Eileen Foster, a former executive who looked at fraud at Countrywide, and she said people belong behind bars, yet she hasn't been asked by the DOJ to testify. So we know what the problems are. So where does this leave us?
Well, those are all good points. It's part of the reason I wrote a novel just as a break, I think, as well. I didn't mention before, because it is hard to continue to bang your head against the wall. The DOJ, the Department of Justice, has been absolutely awful, as you've discussed, as many of us have discussed, at prosecuting anyone. And the most recent case, of course, is MF Global, where for days, John Corzine, the former CEO of this defunct company now that stole $1.2 billion worth of its customer funds, effectively got a free pass from the congressional committee that was asking him questions. There was nothing particularly hard that he couldn't handle, and he just deflected everything. The Department of Justice is supposed to be the department that will look into that matter, and as we've seen, they don't. They're much more likely to. There was a recent SEC case on their website this week about some family who was selling real estate wrong in Salt Lake City, Utah, or something. Those are the things they'll go after, and they may or may not be crimes, but they're not going after the big fish. And so it is really difficult to keep saying that this change is going to come from Washington, from the regulators who are supposed to be doing this, for the Department of Justice, who's supposed to be protecting the people as a federal body in Washington. I think it's going to come more from the attorney generals at the state level not saying no and going after these companies, trying to make some of these crimes stick and looking for legislation that allows them to do that. I think it's going to come from the judges, the ones that do step up at the state level. Judge Rakoff, who recently said that the settlement of $285 million with Citigroup for fraudulent loans wasn't good enough, that the SEC couldn't just settle and not get a wrongdoing admission from the company and have the issue go away, that if they were going to investigate wrongdoing, they have to come to a conclusion. They couldn't settle out of it, which has been what they have done for years. So I think it's going to come from a few individuals who are in positions of power like Judge Rakoff, where they actually can do something, and maybe more judges jumping on board to that philosophy, attorney general, state legislation, because I just do not see this coming from the federal government, not on a congressional level. There are a few senators, of course, who may feel they can do something, but the opposition in Washington to doing anything meaningful to change the way things are, to prosecute, to make the system less risky, to make it more accountable to the population, just don't seem to be there.
What power do attorneys general have? Because maybe this is where we need to start switching gears and really talk about the power they have. Recently, California's Attorney General Kamala Harris decided she didn't want to take part in a national foreclosure probe of some of the biggest banks because she says that this 50-state settlement just doesn't go far enough. So she broke with the Obama administration on this.
Right, which is, and that is the kind of thing where if she continues to do a probe from the perspective of not being part of that overall team, just like Judge Rakoff has basically broken from other judges who have just rubber stamped these settlements, that those individuals have to get our support. I used to say the same thing. I've been talking about books when I wrote Other People's Money, when I wrote Jack, when I wrote Pillage. It's all about, okay, tell your congressperson this, your senator this. I don't think that works. I'm over telling people to do that. I think it's really supporting the people who can at least make dents from their positions, whether it's attorney general or whether it's a judge, and somehow offering them our support, because the national thing isn't working.
Well, let's take another caller.
And they do have the power. They do have the power to investigate. They do have subpoena power. If something happened in their state particularly, they have the power to continue to probe in that state. And if they do work with each other, they can probe across states. But certainly from the New York Attorney General perspective, he has the ability, because a lot of these banks are headquartered in New York, to probe much more deeply into the frauds and crimes that have been committed.
We're speaking with Nomi Prinz, a former Wall Street executive. She worked at Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, and Bear Stearns, and she's now out with her first historical novel, Black Tuesday, which looks at the crash of 1929. And what do you think? Should we start really talking about the power of attorneys general and judges? Because as Nomi says, based on the history of the Obama administration, they're not taking action to re-regulate. They're not going after Wall Street executives despite mounting fraud. So maybe the light should shine now on attorneys general. What do you think? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And what do you think are the solutions to this mounting problem? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Roy in Oakland. Hi, Roy. Welcome to the show. Hello, Roy? Oh, I think we lost Roy. Sorry, Roy, if you can give us a call back. He had a question about Glass-Steagall. Well, why don't we try to ask his question? What do you think about Glass-Steagall, Nomi? Do you ever think that... Well, so it was repealed by President Clinton in 1999.
Right.
And do you think it has a future?
I think it should, and I think it won't, is the short answer. Again, I've been writing about this, as have others, for a while. The Glass-Steagall is one of many larger structural things that should be done to the banking system to diffuse its power of getting government backing to speculate and using customer funds or loans as chips on that speculation table. And the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933 broke up the banks so that if they were going to speculate, that could be their business, but they weren't going to get government support. And the ones that chose to be commercial banks and deal with the population got government support, because technically the government is supposed to be a publicly oriented entity. Today, there were a few senators who, after the subprime crisis in 2008, suggested bringing back something like Glass-Steagall, for example, Senator Bernie Sanders in Vermont, Maria Cantwell in Washington, and it went absolutely nowhere. And instead, these banks were made bigger at the bequest of the Federal Reserve that is supposed to be the regulator of the biggest banks. So rather than regulate them back, Ben Bernanke and the Fed increased their size and scope and influence. So I don't really, again, I don't see the opposition. I think the only place it can come from is really from the bottom up, whether it's from the state level, then pushing it out to federal or something like that, because it's the few voices in Washington that have suggested it have been just beaten back and ignored and really ridiculed.
Well, let's hear from our next caller, Gray in Palo Alto. Hi, Gray. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you. A couple of, maybe a comment quickly, and then turn my radio down. Sorry.
Thank you.
I happen to believe that, unfortunately, there's democracy and capitalism are antithetical to each other, so I'm not sure you're ever going to get this worked out for the benefit of most of the people in this country, even through the democratic process. But that is a comment. Let me just ask two quick questions. One has to do with the fact that interest rates have been kept very, very low for most of this time throughout this a depression, as far as I'm concerned. What this has done is the banks have benefited enormously from the low interest rates. They've been able to borrow money at low interest rates, invest it, make a lot of money. They're whole, but it hasn't really had any impact on the economy because they're not using their money that they've made. So I'm my guess is that this attempt through the low interest rates to try and push the economy has really only benefited the banks. And not the masses of people who could have benefited if that money had been used to, in some way, to promote large job benefits. The other thing is that here in the state of California, you're seeing something. The unemployment rate is starting to go down slightly, especially in the Bay Area. I don't think this is a national trend, and I wonder if your guest has any feel for how different what's going on in the Bay Area and maybe California generally is from the rest of the country? And that's those are the questions.
All right. Thanks, Gray. Naomi?
Gray, yeah, first of all, you're right. On the interest rates and on the cheap money, that's super astute, and it's something that the Federal Reserve refuses to acknowledge, that the money that went to the banking system, the fact that they are financing themselves at near zero interest rates has not been shared with the rest of the country. If it were to have been shared, we would have had better refinancings and restructurings of mortgages rather than homes remaining underwater because banks were helped out of their positions that related to the homes and people weren't helped with the homes themselves. Small businesses will be getting more loans to grow and so forth. So there's definitely not been any sort of trickle-down effect. In fact, the other way around from the banks using this money. And this actually leads into what's happening in Europe. What these banks have actually done is they have increased their derivatives and crazy security exposures specifically to bet on Europe. The growth in their derivatives books is 25 to 30% by virtue of having the ability to get cheap money to fund their position. So not only have they not shared it with the country, they're using it to speculate further and create more risk in the global economy. And there is, going back to what I was saying before, there's no federal notion of changing this, of doing anything about it, of making banks lend, of using more direct loans to people. And I think that's really hurting. With respect to the Bay Area and the rest of California, I live in Los Angeles, and here there really hasn't been an increase in jobs. It's actually gotten a little worse, and there's a lot of layoffs that are happening in the public system in terms of educators and so forth that are still coming between now and year-end, or people basically leaving their positions, being kicked out before Christmas. So it really hasn't changed that much. I'm not entirely sure about the Bay Area, but I think in general where there is growth, it tends to be coming from the smaller or medium businesses that can find alternative ways of funding themselves and creating things and getting people on board. And it's not through lending from banks, but through other means of funding, whether it's through private equity funds or raising money separately or however it is. And I think that's where there is growth or there can be growth.
We have a question from a listener via email that says, why did you want to get involved with Wall Street in the first place? Why did you go to work for these big Wall Street firms?
That's an excellent question. I've been asking myself that for 2 decades. I went because, literally, this is true. I don't say this. I was 19. I had, like my character, Lila, actually, in the book, although that's all. We don't have a lot of similarities. But I was 19. I finished school. I wanted to move to New York. And I had a degree in mathematics, and they were the only people hiring. And it was literally that simple. I didn't even know what a CD was. I didn't know what a bond was. I had no idea. I never took a finance course or an economics course or anything. I knew math. I knew programming. And that's really where the jobs were. And so I started, like a lot of people, as an analyst, you know, analyzing different kinds of securities. And there was an intellectual challenge element to it. I didn't really understand banking, per se. And the more I got into it over the years, the more I realized what was going on, how the hierarchies within banks, the lack of integrity among the people who were rising up the chain, and so forth. And I got really disenchanted and left, and have been writing about it. But I really, it was literally a job when I started.
And because, well, now you live in L.A., and those of us in California are very disconnected from Wall Street. I mean, we hear about it. Maybe we've walked down Wall Street, but what kind of insights can you share with people about how it actually functions? Because you have said that you became disenchanted as you started to climb the ladder and really see what went on behind the scenes.
Because the people that succeed, and some of us see this in the news when we look at John Corzine, who is blatantly, obviously lying to Congress about his knowledge about MF Global and the other CEOs with respect to what their role was in the subprime crisis and dodging questions and all of that. There's a lot of sociopathic characters that make their way up the chain in Wall Street. And when you're still working in it, you're dealing with these people on a day-to-day basis. And it isn't just about, oh, we're going to finance some great new company and that's going to create jobs and all of that, which is the myth I think they might tell themselves. It's really about making money. It's about trading that day. It's about a position that's on the books of a company that's, if it's doing bad, get rid of it, give it to someone else. If it's doing good, take credit for it, tell your boss. And it's a really cutthroat Machiavellian environment. It's very toxic. And the people that rise to the top of these companies, I truly believe, are disconnected from most of humanity, if not all.
We have about maybe 5 to 7 minutes left. And so if you'd like to join us with Nomi Prinz talking about the economy, we'd love to hear from you. How have you been affected? What do you think about what we're facing? How do you make sense of this? Where do you think we're going? 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And on that line of what you were saying about sociopathic characters, they're really glorified in our culture, because as a country, we're so obsessed with media. On one hand, there's so much disdain for powerful bankers and their obvious sense of entitlement and greed. But on the other hand, they've been propped up by the mainstream, the national media. There are constant updates about how the stock market's doing, corporate profits. The media glorifies people like Steve Jobs and not ordinary citizen heroes. So this is still really running through our society.
No, absolutely. And when I in Black Tuesday and in my novel, the bankers at the time, same thing. There was more secrecy even around them, but there was a notion that Jack Morgan, J.P. Morgan's son, was God, you know, at the time. Watson Warner was creating libraries, was doing all these other things with his money. And yeah, he happened to live in several mansions, but that was okay. And it was idolized. And we do have versions of that today, where these people are disconnected from a lot of the country, not just from a humanity standpoint, but from a physical standpoint, in homes and in airplanes and things that don't touch many of the rest of the citizenry. And the media does glorify it. You know, we have CNBC, we have MSNBC, we have Fox Businesses. They're 24/7 bringing CEOs in and saying, where do you see the economy? Where do you see things going? How are things from your vantage point? Where would you be betting your money or investing your money? And you don't have real people being interviewed. It's like that 99% really doesn't make a difference in running this economy, when in fact we actually do. And it's it's sad. I mean, it's bad because the focus of the media, of that media, is what makes these people also have more power, even when they're being villainous.
Let's hear from our next couple of callers. Let's go to Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry.
Hi, yes, good morning. I wanted to hear your opinion on how the euro crisis might shape out and how that's going to affect things here and also in emerging markets.
All right, thanks, Harry. We'll take one more call and then we'll get a response. Let's go next to Mark. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I just want to acknowledge your writing and your reporting, and I wanted to say that I think a large percentage of people don't want to read economic news and they don't want to understand it, so that novels and movies are a way to get across complex ideas to people, and therefore something like Margin Call is a quick way for people to understand a little bit of the complexity.
Is that that's a movie, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I haven't seen that, but I've heard really good things about it.
Very well done, reviewed very well also.
Okay, thank you. And then there's
thank you for writing your book.
Thank you, Mark. There's also Inside Job, the documentary. First, why don't we talk about Harry's question about the euro crisis?
Did you say oil or euro?
The euro crisis.
It was euro, okay. The euro crisis, first of all, and this is not how the mainstream media is really covering it, is largely caused by the financial community and not because all of a sudden these countries didn't have the ability to pay their debts. And this is where that, I want to try to like make it really simple, because the same thing is happening and has happened here, is when a bank makes a bet, they basically take their money, they go somewhere, they may or may not lose that money, and then they get bailed out by a government. And in our case, it's the Federal Reserve. In the case of Europe, it's the ECB, the European Central Bank, the IMF, and so forth. They position it as if they are helping these countries or considering helping these countries. But just like the earlier caller said, that cheap money going into banks doesn't filter into the main economy of the United States, it is exactly the same thing in euro. The reason they are in crisis is because our banks sold them bad assets that they borrowed money to buy. Their banks traded with our banks and did the same thing, and so forth. So what's happening in Europe, and the reason the euro is going down, is because the financial community is trying to make back their money that they bet. And people here and there are being hurt in the process, because the way that the central banks are looking to pay back that money is by taking austerity measures against the populations and so forth. So what's going to happen in Europe is it's going to get worse. There's going to be more talk of austerity. There's going to be more people in the streets. There's going to be less jobs created, because like here, the money that's going in, the fear that if Europe collapses, the U.S. is going to recollapse, even though we're already conveniently stayed in that weakened state, is going to be greater, and money is going to go to Europe, which will go into the financial institutions in Europe and not go into the people in Europe. So we're still in one global connected downward spiral, unfortunately.
Oh, this is it's just such a mess.
It's a mess because the wrong solutions are made, and that they're solutions that help the major banks. They hurt the smaller banks, and they hurt individual populations who are then blamed for their own depressed economies.
Well, all right. So thank you for the call, Harry. What about Mark's question about how this is very overwhelming for people, and people are tired, frankly. They're struggling. Half the country is considered either poor or has a really hard time making ends meet. We just did a show yesterday about food stamps. What do you think about the idea that it's going to take novels and possibly films to get more people involved in this and really demanding the people who have the power to actually make some change here?
I like that idea. I think not just because I wrote the novel, but that was part of the impetus. It's like, I get this stuff is complicated. I mean, I worked in it for years, and I've been trying to unpack it for people for years, but I know it's boring and it's complicated, and yet it affects people. And so what is a way to make it, not entertaining, but just more accessible. And in the novel, there is an element of, there is a crime, there is a court scene, but it's simplified. And part of that is that really fraud is simple. But it's also in a story and hopefully more digestible. I did not see Margin Call yet. I do want to see it, and I know it's good, and I've read some of the reviews on it. But I think things like that, things like Inside Job, are important because it's just easier to digest. You know, you're busy, you're struggling, you're waiting for a job, you're looking for a job, you're paying bills, you've got health issues. You know, you don't have time to sit there and figure out what a derivative is, and I get that. But these things do affect your life, and maybe knowing a little bit more will, for example, cause someone to take money out of, if they have it, in a savings account with a major bank, whereby they're paying the bank to keep their money and put it somewhere else, whether it's in a smaller credit union that pays more interest and doesn't charge a fee, or like under your bed where at least you're flat, you're not paying to have someone keep your money or whatever. You know, that you can get things that can help you in real life without hopefully stressing about analyzing all of these.
And if I remember correctly, there is a scene in your book in which Lila and her boyfriend are talking about margin calls.
Yeah, she has no one has an idea what a margin call is. And basically, it's a bookie calling you up and saying, hey, you want to stay in this bet? You need to sell me, like, your horse. Or get me money somehow, or just do so. Otherwise, you cannot stay in the bed, and I will break your legs. It's like that, but on a financial basis. And yeah, in the book, there's a little bit of unpacking of that margin call.
So
it's like a movie, Guys and Dolls. It's you know, you've got your marker, and you've got to basically be good on it.
So we're at the end of our show, and so basically, you believe that if the change has to come from attorneys general and judges, because the federal government is not acting.
Yes, if there's going to be a change.
All right. Well, we'll continue to explore that because I'm not hearing many people talk about that, but it seems like a place we really should look. Nomi Prinz has worked for Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, and Bear Stearns. She's a journalist, and she's out with her first novel, Black Tuesday. Thanks so much, Nomi.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening. It's Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. What are your favorite books of the year? Do you have a great book to recommend? On the next Your Call, we'll ask Green Apple Books Pete Mulvihill and the booksmith Christian Evans to share their recommendations for the best books of the year. Do you have friends or family members you'd love to get a book for if only you had a recommendation? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What's your book gift idea, and what are you reading? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor. And Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Chuck Feeney of Your Legal Rights. If you or someone close to you has an immigration law problem, please join me this Wednesday evening at 7 on Your Legal Rights. My guests will be Antonio Nieras and Edward Litwin, specialists in immigration law certified by the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar.